You're listening to episode 96 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. Am I doing this right?
Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, Storyteller Tribe! I am so proud that Overdrive is our sponsor for today's new episode. I've been a fan of Overdrive for 6 years, and I am honored to share the exciting news about their brand new app called Libby. It's designed for readers to discover and enjoy ebooks and audiobooks from your library. Have you downloaded Libby on your iPhone or tablet yet? Trust me, you don't want to miss out. I downloaded Libby on my iPhone, and it took me less than 30 seconds to borrow the audiobook versions of Tina Fey's Bossy Pants and Haruki Murakami's Men Without Women. Be sure to hang around at the end of the show so I can tell you more about my experience with Libby. Before I get into more details, if you're new to our show, a warm welcome. I am so happy to have you here. For all my listeners who've been with us for a while, thank you for hanging out with us every week. I'd love to ask you for your support in taking a moment to subscribe to 88 Cups of Tea on iTunes and leave a rating and review. When you take those specific actions, that really helps our show become more visible to new listeners who haven't heard of us before. Thank you so much in advance for helping us grow our community. As some of you might already know, specifically if you're following us on Twitter at 88 Cups of Tea, our 100th episode is coming up real quick on August 10th. That very same week, on August 8th to be exact, I'm turning 30, and 88 Cups of Tea is turning 2 years old, so it'll be a big milestone for sure. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at 88 Cups of Tea, or subscribe to our newsletter, or join our private Facebook group to find out how you can be involved in our combined 2-year anniversary and 100th episode. I'll be making an announcement with all the details very soon, so keep an eye out for it. Now on to today's new episode, we have Kate Schatz with us. Kate is the New York Times bestselling author of Rad American Women A to Z and Rad Women Worldwide. Her books introduce readers to a list of powerful female role models and changemakers. From activists and artists to scientists and rock stars, Kate highlights brave women who've impacted and altered our history for the better. I, for one, am so grateful for books like these. I was honestly quite embarrassed I hadn't known of many of the women featured in Kate's books, but as you'll hear in today's episode, Kate was actually really happy I hadn't heard of them before. Though leaning on the more unfamiliar side, Kate explains that she wants readers to learn about the women whose contributions are equally as incredible as the ones who are more popular in textbooks and the mainstream media. In addition to diving into detail about the inspiration that led her to writing her books, we discuss Kate's collaborative relationship with the illustrator of her books, Miriam Klein-Stahl. Kate also walked us through what the heavy research process was like and which of the women's stories surprised her most during the research phase. For those of you who've talked to me about losing yourself in motherhood, Kate gives really solid and helpful advice on finding yourself again and owning your identity outside of the title of mom. Further into our conversation, we talked about the importance of joining a writing community to inspire your craft and create accountability for yourself, and how to gain the courage to claim yourself as a writer, and she shares her strategy on finding literary agents who are the perfect fit for your writing. Now let's dive right in. We have Kate Schatz with us today. Kate is so cool. I looked her up and I fell head over heels in love with this rad woman. Kate, how are you?
I'm good. Gosh, you're so sweet. You can't see, but I'm blushing now.
Well, thank you. You're passing it over to me. Now I'm feeling tingling in my cheeks.
Oh, mutual blush.
Kate, do you mind sharing a bit about what you're doing right now?
I am in San Jose, California, where it's about 90 degrees, and I am decorating my parents' house because tomorrow I'm throwing them a joint 70th birthday party. They both turned 70 this year, so I'm throwing them a huge party tomorrow.
So freaking awesome. Happy early birthday. By the time it airs, it's going to be happy belated birthday to your parents. And also, I love that you're in San Jose because my girlfriend moved up to San Jose to help her buddies open up a beer spot. Have you been to Original Gravity?
No, but I might go tonight, actually.
She helped to open that before moving down to LA to help open a restaurant. Normally, she doesn't say San Jose because she's like, well, people aren't really familiar with San Jose, so I just say Bay Area.
It's true.
It's so funny because we had another author who was born and raised a little bit in San Jose, and she never said San Jose until I brought up the topic of my girlfriend and where she was. And then she's like, wait, San Jose? I always say Bay Area.
Well, it's funny because San Jose is actually the 11th most populous city in the country. And it's funny, when I travel, I will often say that I live in elsewhere in the Bay Area now, but I'll say I grew up in the Bay Area. But if you're in the Bay Area, like Oakland, and you say you grew up in the Bay Area, and they ask where, and you say San Jose, they'll be like, oh, that's not the Bay Area. People from the Bay, like the core San Francisco and Oakland, often will not consider San Jose part of the Bay Area. It's South Bay, whatever.
That kind of reminds me of New York, Long Island, New York City. So yeah. When I say that I'm from New York, people are always assuming I was living in New York City my entire life. I was only born there, then moved a little bit to Queens before moving to Long Island. But I did schooling and work for acting out in New York City. So I would talk about New York City. Then they find out that most of my life I was raised in Long Island, and all of a sudden they're like, oh my God, don't even come up in here talking about Long Island, all right? You're not from the city, so stop saying New York. I'm like, excuse me, Long Island is in New York, so just because it doesn't have as much street cred doesn't mean it doesn't count. Kate, before I go off on tangent, I would like to hurt it back to why I brought you on the show, which is you write about rad women, and you're a rad woman yourself. First, you had this book come out called Rad Women A to Z, and now this previous year, 2016, you've had Rad Women Worldwide. You have two children, a son and a daughter, I believe, right?
Yes.
I was doing my homework. I'm so excited for listeners to learn more about how your daughter was involved in all of this and how that led to you writing Rad Women A to Z.
Sure. I got the idea to write a Rad American Women A to Z when my daughter was about 2. She just turned 8 2 weeks ago. She's on a field trip to San Francisco with her kung fu camp today.
Wait, did you say her kung fu camp?
Her kung fu camp.
Yes. She's so cool.
But I got the idea when she was about 2 years old. I was going through something that I think is really common, at least for a lot of my friends who are artists who've become parents, which is that there's this really challenging transition with your identity as an artist or a maker when you become a parent. Suddenly you're overwhelmed with babies and you're not sleeping and you're stressed out. And I was finding it actually really hard to be writing. I'd been writing fiction and publishing short stories for a long time. But after I had my daughter, I was feeling creatively brain dead. Part of it is because I was just exhausted and like legitimately underslept and distracted. But I just felt like I was seeing the world in a different way. It also paralleled with having the similar feelings about my identity and my role as an activist. I've long been active in social justice, racial justice, reproductive rights work. And it changed once I had a baby. I had friends that were out organizing and at marches and at protests. This is when Occupy Oakland was really happening. Mm-hmm. I was watching live streams of people running through the streets, getting chased by the cops. And it's like, I would have been doing that. Instead, I was at home breastfeeding a tiny little baby. So I was thinking about a lot about my role, both as a political activist and as a writer, as a mom, and a feminist, all this stuff mushing around in my sleep-addled brain. And then one day when my daughter was taking a nap, it popped into my head, what if I did an alphabet book of cool women from history? We had a lot of A to Z books in our house. It was just full of children's books. And it just popped into my head. I'd always wanted to write a children's book. That was always in the back of my brain as something that I would want to do at some point, because children's literature always meant so much to me growing up. It occurred to me, and I was like, well, this is a pretty cool idea. And I started to bounce it off friends, and everybody was immediately so enthusiastic. It took me several years to actually make it happen, though, as part of the story. It did not just happen immediately. It was several years in the making, but I finally did with the illustrator and we decided to pitch the book. When I initially thought of it, I had no experience in the children's book world with that realm of publishing. It was really, really unfamiliar to me. So I kind of thought, I'm just going to do a Kickstarter for this and I'm just going to do it on my own and self-publish. Luckily, I didn't go that route and we decided to actually pitch it to a publisher.
Dang, good for you. Your collaborator that you reached out to is Miriam Klein Stahl. How did you know about Miriam's work before that? Were you both friends already, or you just put yourself out there and was like, hey, I have this project. I think you are rad and I'd love to team up with you.
Basically, exactly in the middle of that. Miriam was an acquaintance of mine. We had a lot of mutual friends and I knew her work really well. She has been in the activist and punk art scene forever. I knew so many friends that had sweatshirts or screen prints of her work. She had done a lot of these beautiful portrait woodcuts of like James Baldwin, Judy Berry, a lot of great activists and artists. I felt her work had this really iconic, bold look, but we weren't good friends. We'd run into each other here and there and, again, had mutual friends. I decided to send her an email. I really thought that her work was what I would want to go with the book. Like, when I envisioned what the illustrations would look like, I envisioned work that looked like hers. What I liked is that it felt as strong and bold as the women that I was writing about. I didn't want cutesy, flowy, fluffy illustrations. I really thought a lot about the book appealing both to kids and adults, and I wanted it to be art. I wanted it to be bold, modern, graphic, beautiful-looking art, and that's what Miriam's work is. So I sent her a really, really long, way too wordy email about this idea that I had, and I'm sure you're too busy, and da-da-da, and she just wrote back and said, sure, let's do it.
Oh my God, Miriam is awesome.
And I was like, oh, okay. And we met at a coffee shop and we brainstormed and we were totally on the same page. And then she texted me that night and she was like, great, I have about 6 of the illustrations already finished.
Holy, are you serious?
Yeah. So I always say that one of the best things about our collaboration, now several years later, we're basically business partners and we love working together. But one of the great things is she just really motivates me. She's a fast worker. She's a hard worker. Mm-hmm. All the illustrations in the books are paper cut. She takes a black piece of paper. She takes a lot of time to draw the image, and then she takes an X-Acto knife and she cuts it out.
Wow.
It's a beautiful process to watch. I really think that if I hadn't partnered with her, that could have been one of those ideas that I had in my head and I said I was going to do forever.
But the execution wouldn't have gone through.
Yeah. But because I partnered with her, she's a hard worker and she just gets stuff done, then I think that's why we've been able to do it.
Love that. Usually when I've had authors of children's books on, they usually say that they don't have the ability or opportunity to partner or collaborate with an illustrator. Their agents then recommending to publishers and whoever, and that's how the illustrator gets involved through a third party.
We were both completely new to the children's book world, as was our publisher. We worked with City Lights and they'd never done a children's book in their 70-year history.
Oh, wow.
I actually think that so much good came out of that, the fact that we were completely new to it. I had no idea that that was such a common thing. Again, most children's book writers and illustrators are kept really separate. There are some really great collaborations out there, but we're really lucky that we were able to do that. We pitched the book together. We've totally been able to work together and collaborate. So it is really quite rare. At first, it seemed totally bizarre to me that that was the case, because the whole job of an illustrator is to tell the same story that the writer's writing, but to do it in a visual way. And the author is often going to have their idea of what should go on the page.
Yeah.
The illustrator's whole job is to do that. So they keep them apart. Now, I'm really glad that we can collaborate and get to work together.
Wow, that's amazing. You two work so well together, like you said. And also, how much more of a better accountability partner could you have asked for? For Miriam, too, having you on her team, I think that's so extraordinary and just so rare. And I'm assuming, because that means that you and Miriam were doing a lot of research together, or was it focused, you did all the research, then you brought it to her and laid it out in bullet points so that she has an idea of how to illustrate it? How did that work? Or you both jumped into the research process?
When we partnered on the first book, I had already planned about, I'd say 70% of the women that I wanted to put in the book. And then we kind of worked together on the rest. She'll often suggest people that we should write about, because at this point, we both get a lot of suggestions from other people. You know, folks are always sending us a link or tagging us in an article on Facebook and say, hey, check out this story about this rad woman from history, which is great. So we do a kind of different kind of research, though. Miriam's research is more on the visual element. So she looks at a lot of different source images for each person that we choose to write about.
Okay.
She's been doing a lot more lately, which I think is great, is instead of creating her image from one single source, she's been watching a lot of videos and creating original images from videos. She's on a new book right now, and there's a couple of musicians that I'm writing about. She felt like the still images were just a little boring. So for some of them, they're really old-timey, so she's watching these old videos, and some are more contemporary, so she's watching YouTube. And then she's creating original images from those sources. She has a different kind of research, whereas since I'm writing the stories, I'm doing the historical research and that, but she does a more visual research.
Got it. I would love to start off with first Rad Women A to Z. What was that research like? I know that Rad Women A to Z, you only featured women from America. And yeah. Then your second book, for the Rad Women Worldwide, was all around the world. So let's start with the A to Z one. What was that like? What was it like reaching out to them? Was it very difficult? How long was that process?
I wasn't going directly to people. I wasn't conducting actual real life interviews, in part because a lot of the people that I wrote about are no longer alive. The process was about a year total. I do the best that I can to be finding primary sources. If I can talk to the person, that's number one. Great. Mm-hmm. If I can't, I am trying to find anything that they wrote. If they wrote an autobiography, if they wrote a memoir, I watch speeches that the women have given. I will watch documentaries. I try to use as many sources as I can. And with the Rad American Women, it was easier for me because I had a basic understanding of American history. With each woman I was researching, I understood the context that she was working in. I didn't have to do too much research into that. With the second book, with Rad Women Worldwide, it was a lot more challenging because not only was I researching an individual woman in her life, but in many cases, I was also having to learn about her time period, the cultural history, the political history, everything that was going on in her part of the world at that time, which often wasn't something that I felt super knowledgeable about. It was really fun kind of research, though. I love doing it. I'm not an historian. I definitely like to point this out. This is something that I'm really interested in. I'm a completely amateur researcher. This is not something I have any kind of professional training in. I just like reading and I like learning about new people.
The work that you put into it, first of all, I wasn't aware of a lot of the women that you mentioned.
Good.
And I felt really schooled, like nobody's business. And I was like, damn, thank you, Kate. Was that very intentional on your end to make sure you highlighted people who were overlooked by media throughout our history?
Absolutely. There's a reason you haven't heard of them. And it's because people write about the same people over and over. So people have that reaction a lot, which is like, oh, I felt so bad. I'd never heard of them. So I want that reaction. I want you to have not heard of a lot of these people, but no one should ever feel bad about it, right? It's not our fault. It's just that we tend to learn about and be told about the same stories over and over. So we're really interested in pushing beyond that and just introducing more names and faces. This happens when we learn history in school growing up. We tend to have a few main figures that stand in for different time periods and different social movements. In the US, kids learn about the civil rights movement. You get Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King. That's why Rosa Parks is not the R in our first book. And I talk to kids about that all the time. They always ask, is R for Rosa Parks? And then I say no, and they often get all sad. They're like, no. And so I tell them, and I say, well, how many of you have heard of her? And they all raise their hand. Mm-hmm. And then I say, well, how many of you have heard of Ella Baker? Not as many of them raise their hand. And I say, well, that's why I wrote about Ella instead of Rosa, because Ella was also a very important part of the civil rights movement, and I want you to learn about more people. But at the same time, we are also writing about familiar people because, one, we need to sell books, but we want people to be interested. And you know, the way that we're conditioned is such that if something feels completely unfamiliar and foreign, we often get intimidated and don't want to look at it. That's why in our second book, we have recognizable people on the cover like Malala and Frida Kahlo, who a lot of our readers are going to recognize. And that's people's in. They're like, oh, I know those people. And then they're able to open the book and learn about all these other folks that they have not heard of.
I love that. And now touching on that book, Rad Women Worldwide, how did you know about like the very first woman that you featured is, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Eneduanna? This is during Mesopotamia times. How was she even brought to your attention?
I learned about Eneduanna, who is the first known writer. So she predates Sappho, she predates Confucius. She is the first person to have signed her name to a poem, which was found in clay fragments in the desert of Iraq. She was an ancient Sumerian priestess and poet. And I learned about her from a professor at UC San Diego named Anna Joy Springer, who's a professor of creative writing. And Anna Joy is an old friend of Miriam and mine. And when she heard we were writing the book about women around the world, she emailed me and said, you have to write about Eneduanna. And Anna Joy she's amazing feminist writer, and she's been obsessed and fascinated with Eneduanna. So that's where I learned about her. And that's where I learned about a lot of people in that book. A number of the people in that book actually came from people like Anna Joy, but also folks who would come to our events, to our readings, and would hear that we were doing a worldwide book, and they'd come up to us after and say, hey, have you heard of this person? And I would write it down. I have a little app in my phone where I keep notes. A number of them came from other people. For the worldwide book, I did a lot of outreach to people from other countries, either friends or acquaintances, and I also use social media. I'm not from Canada. I'm not from Brazil. I'm not from Japan. So I wanted to hear from people from those countries who they felt should go in the book. And that's what influenced a lot of the choices.
So I was actually going to ask you about Chu Jin. You mentioned it's like the modern day Mulan and China's first feminist. I'm from Chinese background. For me, I'm just like, wait, how did I not hear of her? Dang, Kate did such a good job. Holy moly. You would think that I would know because maybe my dad might have known or his grandparents might have passed it down to him. Then he would pass it down to me. But no, I had no idea. I was so happy to learn about her.
Yeah.
Thanks for featuring her and all these incredible women. Chu Jin, for her specifically, what was her case like? Did you know people from China that you could reach out to for her specific story?
Yes. There's a couple that lives, now they live in the Bay Area, a Chinese couple that lives in the Bay Area, who did a documentary about her. When I first read about her, and I'm pretty sure I read about Chu Jin initially online, I just read all kinds of articles, and I'm always just doing weird Google searches, and I come across these names, and I kind of start tracking down these stories. Then I saw that there was this documentary about her, and they're some of the leading researchers and scholars on her. So I reached out to them and was able to, I'm actually blanking on their names right now. I thank them in the back of the book, but I had a really great email correspondence with them, and they were able to help me fact check what I wrote, give me a little bit of insight into her, and they helped me figure out how to correctly pronounce her name. So I did that with a lot of the stories. Again, if the people are not alive, I tried to find anybody who's a scholar on them. I write about the Irish pirate Grace O'Malley, and there's a woman in Ireland who's the leading scholar on her. So I wrote to her, a number of other people who've already done this research, you know, people who, again, I'm a complete amateur here. So I reached out to people who are actual professional historians and could give me that insight.
That's so badass. I love the accuracy. I'm really happy that you also featured, again, I hope I'm pronouncing right, Aung San Suu Kyi, because my mom was the one who told me about her. And my mom's obsessed with her. Like, she follows her stories and loves her. And she's a role model to my mom. And also, she was thrilled that there was a movie made about her starring Michelle Yeoh, who was one of the Bond girls. That was super amazing. When I saw that, I was like, oh my gosh, I have to tell my mom. She's going to freak out. Readers like me, I do get super excited when I learn about people I've never heard about. But then also to recognize women, like you said, a lot of people would recognize Malala, for example. We freak out. We're just like, yes, like, you know, go girls. Like, these are the ones that we've been following and that we admire. On your end, collecting these stories and all the research that you've been doing and reaching out to historians and professors, was there one particular research for one particular woman that you featured that was a really fun behind-the-scenes story that you could share with us? Like, whether that meant tracking down a source that was, oh my gosh, it was like the most difficult way of tracking them down or the most bizarre way of getting that story. Is there anything they could share with us?
Let's see. So I'm trying to think. A couple come to mind. I'd say the one that was probably the most fun for me to research that surprised me the most was the story of Josephine Baker. Research-wise, it wasn't really crazy, but I just had no idea about her story. I was familiar with her as this figure from the jazz flapper era. I knew that she was an African-American woman who was very popular in Paris and did the Charleston. I knew the basic of her. A number of people suggested I write about her, and I was, oh, okay, you know, yeah, she was in movies, she's interesting. And I started to read about her, and I had no idea that she actually had become a spy during World War II. There's these fascinating stories about her as a spy. And then she came back to the United States and was this total civil rights pioneer. I just had so much fun learning about her because she was someone I assumed I knew about. And then I realized I totally did not. And then I'd say that probably the most challenging and interesting to research was Dame Katerina Matera from New Zealand. And she's probably one of the most obscure figures in the book. She's a Maori woman from New Zealand, part of the indigenous people of New Zealand, who's really credited with keeping the Maori language alive in New Zealand and really revitalizing it in a way that's influenced a lot of other folks who've tried to bring back indigenous languages that are on the brink of extinction. She passed away a couple of years ago. It was very hard to write about her because there's very little about her, and much of it is in a language I cannot speak. I was able, through Twitter and all kinds of weird ways, I finally was able to get put in touch with her children. I tracked down all these different New Zealand Maori writers. It was like this whole weird chain of emails and contacts, and I finally got in touch and ended up on this email thread with her 10 children. And I wanted them to know that we were writing about their mother and to see if they would be willing to read what I'd written and look at the illustration. Legally, we do not have to seek permission to tell these stories in the book because everything we're working with exists in the public domain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But as a matter of respect, I do my best to try to get in touch and let people know, hey, we're writing about you or we're writing about this person. If they're deceased, I try to find their family. Basically wanted to let her children know, and I was on this email thread with all 10 of her children, most of whom were just really excited and really thrilled that their mother would be in this book. And there was like one really skeptical son. I mean, it ended up being fine, but he was very skeptical and had a really understandably legitimate sense of who are these white American writers
oh, no.
who are going to try to write about my mom, some weird American book. And then he ended up in this back and forth for so long with Miriam, with the illustrator, because he didn't think that the mouth in the illustration looked enough like his mother. And that's legit. And we want you to feel like this is a representation of your mother who's passed. So Miriam went to great lengths and communicated back and forth with his son to tweak her paper cut so that it looked exactly like they wanted it to look. In the end, everybody was happy with it.
I think that's so admirable that you did that. I'm so thrilled that he ended up being okay with the photo and that he's happy about it and he gave you the A-OK stamp on it. Have any of your emails and contacts, has it led you to fly out to that specific country or no, you did it all from the U.S.?
I wish that that was part of ours. I have not yet traveled to another country. Rad Women Worldwide, it's getting translated into a couple languages for publication. It's going to be coming out in Brazil. I have a secret hope that the Brazilian publisher is going to fly me there. But it's also coming out in Korean, and there's going to be a North American Spanish edition, and then actually in Spain as well.
Can you imagine being sent and flown to all these countries to talk about the book in person? I'm keeping my fingers crossed for you.
Thank you. Maybe someone from the publisher will hear this podcast and realize that they should totally do.
They're like, we're going to just throw Kate and Miriam on a flight out to Korea and to Spain.
I'm available. I would go. Another fun little connection that came through.
Oh my God, yeah, please.
Again, through the magic of Twitter, we ended up going back and forth for some time with Malala's father.
How was that like?
Amazing. Out of the blue, he started sending me these messages saying, because I had the publisher send a book to them through the Malala Foundation, and it ended up getting to him. I suddenly looked at my phone. I was like, oh, I have a DM from Malala's father. And it was just this very sweet note about how much they had appreciated and enjoyed the book. And I was so amazed. And then they kept coming and there were more and more. And he sent me like 10 messages. And each one was this rapturous note about what it means to patriarchal societies to have women represented this way. And
wow.
He was so sweet and kind. And he said, you know, Malala was studying for final exams, so she could not send Twitter messages. But very appreciative of the book.
That is so sweet. And it's so true because it was like huge news that she ended up joining Twitter after her final exams.
It was just that she turned 20 yesterday.
Yes, yesterday was her birthday. I remember that. I admire her so much and how much she upholds education.
If only we all waited to join Twitter until we were done studying or finishing our work or whatever.
I was just telling my girlfriend yesterday when I was reading her section in your book, her story, her feature that you highlighted, I wish that I appreciated my education more when I was in high school instead of taking it for granted, like a lot of kids do. And I definitely was one who was cutting class and going late and really didn't even think twice about it. And seeing how hard other children fight for their right for education. When I read her story, I felt like such an ungrateful douchebag. I was like, oh, I wish I could turn back time to like appreciate what I'm being taught.
Good news is she's become such an icon with young people. I travel to schools. I talk to young people a lot. Like she's a rock star to them. But what that means is that they're reading and absorbing that story. So I've been able to have a lot of conversations with kids about, doesn't her story make you appreciate?
Yes.
And then they're like, yes. So I was a little similar to you in school. I did not take it as seriously as I wish I had. But I wonder if I'd had a role model or an example like Malala, if that would have helped. To be honest, I probably still would have ditched class here and there. But maybe in the back of my head, I would have been like, oh, what would Malala say?
I know, right? What would she say if she was in my class and she's my friend? Kate, there were two things that really, really stood out to me. One of them being that when you talked about having your children, it was almost a loss in identity. I love that you mentioned that because most of our listeners are women. Also, a lot of them are moms. And a lot of them have gone through exactly what you said when I would send out emails asking, hey, what's going on right now? Checking in. How are you feeling? What is like your most difficult situation? And quite a few listeners have written back saying, ever since I've had my child or my children, I just feel like my identity is mom or wife, and it's not me. And also, just FYI, our listeners are also writers or working on writing. So for them, there's so many times they hit writer's block or just completely drop their manuscript that they were working on so hard for years before their children were born. And then they end up in almost a depression. So if there's anything from what you've gone through, I mean, twice with both your children, that you can share and pass on to these listeners of ours, our community.
Oh my gosh, so many things. All those things are just totally real, for one. I'm known in some circles. There's a lot of people in this world who know me as like Ivy's mom. That's my kid. They know me as Kate, but I'm also Ivy's mom. And that's just kind of part of what comes with being a parent. Couple things. I can't overstate the importance of having a creative community, whether it's a mentor that you can look to, having a writing group. If you know other writers, having a writer's group that meets regularly, I think that that's incredibly important because it can hold you accountable to getting that manuscript done and getting work done, and also gives you regular writing community, a creative community, and gives you something to look forward to often. I would say for people who, if you don't have a writing group and you want to start one, you can do it with friends. If you don't have any friends who are writers and you're the only one, you can use social media, use Craigslist, find a way, put up a flyer at the library and see if you can do that. I know a lot of people have a book club that they're in and you do that for reading, but do that for writing. I think it's really, really helpful. Also for me, I guess I would suggest to other people is don't be afraid to talk about yourself as a writer, even if you haven't published anything or if you haven't published for a long time. I mean, even after I had published a lot of short stories, and then even after I'd published my first book of fiction, I didn't always immediately identify myself as a writer. I was also teaching full time. I remember being at a party with a friend and someone said, "Oh, what do you do?" I said, "Oh, I'm a teacher. Oh, and I'm, you know, kind of a writer." And an old friend of mine was there and she guffawed and said, "What are you are a writer. You have to claim that. You know, what are you kind of a writer?" And I think that sometimes we let our own insecurities about our success as a writer or lack thereof prevent us from really claiming that that's what we are. And I know that for me, after I had my daughter, I hadn't published anything for a few years. I was teaching, I got pregnant, I was doing all these other things in my life, and I would meet these new moms. And this is what happens, you know, you have a kid, you suddenly meet all these other parents of babies. You meet them at the park or in like a play group or whatever. All you talk about is your baby, and you just talk about, "Oh, does she sleep? Does she eat? Does she poop? Blah, 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 blah." I found myself kind of going crazy with that. And it took me a while to figure out, how can I actually talk about who I am in these circles? I just did. I don't know if there's a right way to do it, but I would just say, if you're in that situation where you feel like you're with other moms and all you ever talk about is just mom stuff, change the conversation. Don't be afraid if someone asks you what you're up to, how you're doing. Don't just say, "Oh, everything's fine. You know, I'm just hanging out with my kids." Say like, "Oh, I've got this book I'm trying to finish," or, "I just published an essay." I think I'd really encourage people to own themselves as a writer and really make sure people know that aspect of you, and not to force that identity on people, but don't be afraid to claim it and to really celebrate it.
Woof, that was powerful. Thank you for that, Kate. And the second thing, I know you mentioned that when you and Miriam were first starting off, you both had no idea what you were doing. You dived in and you were swimming and floundering, but just getting the work done. And then I guess your intuition was guiding you. So
yes.
In that case, is there anything that you can pass on to the listeners?
First of all, I always feel like a beginner when I'm writing. Literally every time I sit down to write something new, whether it's an essay, even if it's like a short essay for my publisher's website, I'll just sit down and stare at a Word document and be like, "I don't know how to do this." Even with the Rad Women books, I'm writing a new one right now. And it's like every time I sit down to write a story about a new person, I'm, "Oh, what do I do? How does this work?" So over time, I've just come to embrace that. I understand my process. It's messy. I just start writing and it takes shape at some point. And so you have to just trust your intuition, trust that you're good at what you do. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing it, and trust that you'll get to that point. In terms of the professional aspect, publishing, agents, et cetera, et cetera, I mean, it's hard. That's one thing, is just accept that it's hard. Accept that you're going to get rejected. That's part of the game. I think that the best thing a writer can do to minimize rejection, you can never eliminate rejection, or you can never guarantee success, but I think you can mitigate the degree to which you'll fail and get rejected, is just to be as smart and strategic as possible with where you try to place your work and who you try to connect with professionally, whether it's an agent for representation or a publisher or a publication. Know where you belong. Often writers waste a lot of time, burn a lot of intellectual and calories and hours of the day trying to chase people or publications that just aren't the right fit. So I think that if you can have a really realistic view of what your writing is, who you are as a writer, and where you belong, it'll help direct you to the people that you should be directed to, if that makes sense. A friend of mine, she just asked me the other day, she said, oh, do you have any, started to write nonfiction and memoir? And she said, are there any agents you know of that are really good with that? And I was like, well, I would suggest actually working backward. Find the writers that you really like, publishing work that feels really similar to yours. If you picture a bookshelf, who is your work on the shelf with? And then look in their books and figure out who are their agents? Where are they publishing? If you're a poet, find the poets you like and find the magazines that published their poems before they went into the book. If you're writing memoir, what are your top 10 favorite memoirs and your favorite memoirists? Get their books, read their acknowledgments. They always thank their agent. If they don't, they're in trouble. And I actually, it's how I started in a lot of ways. I was noticing that there were all these writers that I liked, and I noticed that they were all blurbing each other's work. I basically started to figure out how all these writers were connected. There's like this constellation of these different writing scenes. And I started to piece it together by looking at who was blurbing who. And then I started to see these places all publish the same people. And oh, wow, those people all actually have the same agent. And I just worked to figure out the landscape, like the map of the world. And then I tried to figure out where I should live on that map.
Kate, that was freaking so good. Thank you for all those nuggets of wisdom. I really appreciate that.
As I've been a teacher for many, many years.
You speak so well, the way you explain everything, whether it's sharing your stories and experiences to giving advice.
Thank you. Well, I taught high school and college for many years. And in order to captivate and instruct a room full of high school students, you have to be very succinct.
No wonder. I see you've gotten a lot of practice. That's awesome.
I can speak to an audience of 500 people. I'm like, fine, I have captivated 30 15-year-olds for 1 hour. I can talk to anybody. They're the toughest audience. In a hot, stuffy classroom, the last period of a Wednesday.
Oh, heck no. I'd be sleeping.
My job is to keep them awake. So it's prepared me for this moment.
Kate, you are so awesome. Please let us know where we can find you on social media. And if there's anything else you'd like to share, if we should look out for anything. I know you're also co-founder of Solidarity Sundays. If you want to go into that, you're more than welcome to.
Yes, very brief plug for that. So in addition to being a full-time writer, I'm at this point basically a full-time political activist and organizer. And I co-founded and co-run a nationwide group called Solidarity Sundays, which is we have an online community and a real in real life community. So we have a Facebook group called Solidarity Sundays, and we're solidaritysundays.org. And we're basically a network of, at this point, almost 300 chapters of mostly women that meet in people's homes once a month, the second Sunday of each month, to take coordinated political actions. Right now, we have a lot to be resisting. So we're part of the resistance. We focus on a different issue or theme each month. We bring in guest speakers. And we educate ourselves and we take really specific action. A lot of it is writing letters, emails, postcards. We've been making phone calls around healthcare, around immigration, and we work to empower our communities. And we also encourage people to really focus on super local issues as well. That's Solidarity Sundays. It's a network of feminist activist groups. I'm really easy to find on the internet. I have a website, kateschatz.com. I'm on Twitter at kateschatz. So it's just my name, KateSchatz. And I'm on Facebook. I'm on all that stuff.
I love that you mentioned what Solidarity Sundays was about, because a lot of our community members, ever since the election results, most of us have been pretty down, a lot of us being depressed. And I think there's many that are looking for a way to be involved and proactive, but also having a support group so you're not sinking in this hole of depression on your own. So it's really important right now to have a community to lean on. So thank you for mentioning that. And please, listeners, if you are interested, I know there's a lot of you who have been looking for something like this. Please do check it out.
We make it easy to take political action. And that's actually why we started it. I started it with a friend of mine. We're both parents. We're both activists. We started it about a year and a half ago, so well before the election. We wanted to give our friends and community members who weren't activists, quote unquote, but who had a lot of opinions and felt frustrated, but didn't really know what to do. We wanted to give them a space to do that. That's obviously increased 1,000,000,000% since the elections. We make it easy. You get in touch with the host of a chapter near you. You show up. They give you a packet of information and action. You eat snacks and you hang out. You feel like you've done something.
Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And I should note one final thing. It just occurred to me, I am doing this interview with you. I'm actually in my childhood bedroom. Doesn't look like my childhood bedroom anymore, but I'm at my parents' house. But I remember I used to sit in here for hours with a tape recorder and talk to myself and make recordings of myself doing books. When I was a kid, because I was obsessed with reading Rainbow and I wanted to be one of those kids that talked about a book. So I heard myself talking about books. So it feels very full circle.
I was going to say that is full circle right there. Holy.
I'm talking to my laptop instead of my red Panasonic tape.
Oh my gosh.
Things change, but not too much.
Right. Thank you so much for sharing that. I have goosebumps everywhere on my arms, by the way. I'm just looking at them right now. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Yin. It was really, really fun to talk to you.
And that wraps up our episode with the rad woman herself. Kate, it was so much fun having you on the show, and thank you for that incredible conversation. Storytellers, I hope Kate's episode inspired you. I've been wanting to bring on some authors who specifically approach and tackle social issues in children's books. So if you enjoyed Kate's episode, be sure to pay special attention over the next few episodes that feature guests who have similar visions of instilling change in our younger generation. As always, I am so happy you make the conscious effort to hang out with us each week. Seriously, thank you for being the best tribe. Please hop on over to Twitter and say hi to Kate at Kate Shots, and head over to her show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/KateShots. At the top of the show, I talked to you about the audiobook versions of Tina Fey and Haruki Murakami's books that I borrowed from Overdrive's new reading app called Libby. I downloaded Libby on my iPhone last week, and oh my god, it's been a game changer. I've already been a huge fan of Overdrive for 6 years as soon as I first discovered them through a library down the block from me. Just as an FYI, Overdrive was the reason I got into audiobooks in the first place. But after they built their new app Libby, the ebooks and audiobook selections are even easier and smoother to browse through. Makes complete sense after I found out that the design was inspired by user and library feedback and was built to get people reading as quickly and seamlessly as possible. Side note, Libby has also been designed to recommend awesome books to read next. I see tons of audiobooks and ebooks on my Libby app from our previous 88 Cups of Tea guests like Saba Tahir, Sarah J. Maas, Cami Garcia, Jeff Zentner, and a lot more authors you'll recognize. While millions of people around the world use their library to read books every day with Overdrive, half of the United States alone doesn't have a library card. Overdrive wants to change that with Libby, and I could not be more proud to collaborate with a team that exists to spread literacy, reading, and libraries. Be sure to download Libby on your phone or tablet and start borrowing audiobooks and ebooks from your favorite authors. Head over to meet.libbyapp.com. Again, that's meet.libbyapp.com. And don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other listeners from our show at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I can't wait to meet you in there. Again, that's facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Have an amazing rest of your week, and I will catch you in the next episode. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.